Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Jack Spencer, Jake McCansler, Abigail Walls, and Simon Schuster. A little later, Liz Kirkwood, she's an attorney with Flo, is going to be joining us to talk about what else but the Line 5 pipeline. But first, we had some breaking news this morning, Abigail, where Governor Snyder is going to be using his 501c4 nonprofit account to produce six similar-looking 30-second videos. They are going to be on TV. They're going to be going in districts that some of these didn't really make our most likely to flip list, our top 15.
Well, aside from Representative Kesto and Representative Iden, none of these have cracked our top 15 list. And my guess is that with HRCC focusing its resources on those 15 most likely to flip, perhaps the governor's kicking in a little bit to help some of these candidates that need the name ID to push it past the post.
And for our listeners' benefit, we're talking about Pamela Hornberger in the 32nd District, Bronna Kale in the 57th House District, Julia Alexander in the 64th, and Beth Griffin in the 66th. Now, three of those four, Jack, have been represented by a Democrat in the not-too-distant past. Is Snyder playing in areas where maybe his popularity would be better than other parts of the state?
My guess would be they're going after a segment of the voting population where he would be helpful, where he's popular. And my thought process would be, okay, are they afraid of moderate Republicans who aren't particularly happy with Trump? Are they trying to give them a little push and point them toward the bottom of the ticket just to kind of reinforce, hey, you still have to get out there and vote whether you vote for Trump or not?
Well, let's go ahead and we're going to play one of these videos. We'll listen to the audio, obviously, and give the listeners just a little taste of what we're talking about here.
Michigan is coming back, but there's more to do. Under Governor Rick Snyder's leadership, over 450,000 jobs have been created. Unemployment is the lowest in 15 years, and education funding is at record levels. Michigan's comeback will stay alive with leaders like Brant Iden. Brant Iden is focused on bringing good-paying, full-time jobs to West Michigan. Brant Iden deserves our thanks for his leadership in fighting for jobs. Visit MichiganComebackStory.org to continue the comeback.
Paid for by making government accountable.
Thoughts?
I'd be interested to see the numbers. Are these districts where Snyder still polls particularly well, and so you're tying these folks to the governor's popularity rather than gambling with the top of the ticket?
Jack?
Yeah, I think they're worried about the top. I also think from Trump's perspective, we know there's a real divide on his message about Michigan and Trump's message about Michigan, you know, having crashed and burned.
Right.
So there's an even stronger, probably, appeal to the idea we've got to do some positive things on what's happening with the people who are in power in Michigan. And here's these candidates that are running for election or re-election. So get that story out there, because there's a real clash of the two messages coming from the national Republicans and what Snyder and the state Republicans.
I agree with both of you here. I think the only other thing I would add is that I think it is significant that these are districts that would seem to go Republican anyway and are represented more or less, it's what would you call these 55% districts, where Snyder's going in there would do no harm and would only seem to benefit with a little extra name ID for these candidates. Take them off the board so HRCC, like you said, Abby, can focus on the real battlegrounds like Holly Hughes or something of that nature.
I mean, this is clearly a political season where the ideas of perspectives on Snyder's legacy are becoming very fractured, especially as we move towards the tail end of his administration. And I think that he's found the areas in which that legacy is viewed upon favorably, and he can lever it to his political advantage.
All right, let's talk about something that Governor Snyder is going to have to deal with here fairly shortly, and that is the signing of the medical marijuana legislation. This hasn't been warmly embraced by everybody in the medical marijuana community because it seems like to them this is more business and corporations getting involved by a community, I guess, that is very much the antithesis of corporate takeover of business. They like to grow their marijuana, and then they like to get it to the guy down the street when they got an overage, and they can kind of sell it and kind of make a buck. This is very much a very structured, tiered system, like what we have for alcohol, right? I mean, instead of like a three-tier system, it's almost like a five-tier system. You got the people who grow, you got the people who transport it in the armored truck, you got people who process it, you got the people who test it, and then you got the people who sell it. And never shall the two cross, right? You can't be in the growing industry and the testing industry or any combination of the five. And that's kind of a touchy area, Simon, for folks who like the grass and like dealing with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the evolution that Michigan is going through right now is really strongly mirrored in the first state in the union to legalize marijuana, which is Colorado. They legalized medical marijuana in 2000, but until 2007, they had a limit where caregivers could only, there was no storefront dispensaries, and caregivers could only deliver five patients. But they were sued by an advocacy group. That paved the way for the commercialization of medical marijuana. But then in 2009, the state tried to reinstate this five caregiver rule, and it wasn't until their state legislature passed legislation that allowed medical marijuana dispensaries to come through. And you know what? 3 years later, recreational marijuana was legalized throughout the state.
Interesting. So maybe we're following kind of a similar path, and now there are a couple other states that allow recreational marijuana to some extent, and now there's going to be more that are on the ballot coming up here. Jack, what's your take here on this?
Well, I don't know that you would expect your average medical marijuana user to get excited about the creation of a bureaucracy and the creation of a lot of technical things. That I don't think that's the kind of thing that would actually excite an average user who's worried about just making sure they get their product, making sure they get their meds for that week or whatever. They actually probably should be more excited than they are, because once you start realizing, once you create the bureaucracy, once you create the tiers, there's maybe nothing that you can do that guarantees that it will continue in the long run. You know, as President Reagan said, you know, there's nothing closer to immortality than a government program. So from that perspective, if they were thinking about it that way, they probably should get excited about it. But I just don't, I think it's a lot to expect people to say, oh, they're putting in this whole regime of rules and so on and get excited about it. I wouldn't expect a lot of them to get excited.
Well, that's a great take there, too. And this almost makes it easier to legalize marijuana if you think about it, because the structure is now in place. Now the folks who want to legalize it don't have to create a structure. And that was the problem that we had in this last ballot drive, isn't it, Jacob? We had two different, possibly three different structures, and it was like, okay, which one are we going to use?
It's kind of an interesting observation what you did there, because you talked about kind of how maybe not the medical marijuana community is happy about this. I kind of started off with, they got some of the things they want, right? Like, there was the desire for medibles, right? And there, Simon documented kind of the issues, legal issues with dispensaries just kind of hanging out in legal limbo. So you take care of both those things, but then, you know, the lawmakers and law enforcement take it a step further and create this regulated and tiered system. So you started with those things, but then it became a little bit more, and now you have all the structure there that could pave the way for recreational there.
I mean, I think we've seen with the the leaky enforcement that we've had of marijuana laws in general, that people would much rather see people buying this drug from a storefront rather than a street corner. And from the perspective of dispensary owners, while they have been operating with no taxation or really any regulation to speak of, which is, of course, you know, from a business perspective, not a bad thing, they are really in very much an existential limbo. They do not know whether or not they will be shut down in the next few weeks or not. And I think that really for them, this boils down to how much are they willing to pay for their security as a business.
Well, yeah, I mean, this really legitimizes medical marijuana for really the first time. As long as you go through the proper steps, you run it through your local government. And here in Lansing, Virge Bonero loves medical marijuana shops because he sees crime being cut down. He sees storefronts that were once vacant now occupied by somebody. And people are coming from across the state to come here and buy their marijuana, and they're by and large law-abiding citizens. They get it. They spend their money, and then they leave. He loves this law.
I have a question, Simon, because we were talking before about the cost in of marijuana in Colorado. And what I would think with regulation, as you regulate something, you increase the capital entry point for a small business owner or somebody who wants to open the dispensary. So is this like a concern? I mean, Jack was talking about users could get excited about this legislation, but if you were dealing or growing on an unregulated way, wouldn't you be upset by this, potentially putting you out of business or costing you more money?
Well, and that depends. I mean, right now, because of the way that the caregiver structure is structured in the Michigan Medical Marijuana Act, If you are providing marijuana to more than five people, if you're growing more than 72 plants total, you are risking being shut down, being jailed, and being charged with any number of laws. So really, I mean, when you look at an industry like marijuana, which is a crop that is largely grown in tightly controlled conditions, indoors, with highly technical processes, you have a lot to gain by scaling your operations to the point where it becomes very visible, and perhaps, and you know, so that when you, if you're operating in a legal gray zone, they would really threaten your presence. But if, you know, with things are in clear, you can scale to an extent that I think things would become much more profitable. And right. When you look at Colorado too, in their first year, there was a lot of uncertainty about the first year marijuana became legalized, about what the implications were. And one of the things that advocates used that really kind of helped seal the deal and establish it as something that was here to stay for Colorado was the numbers. And what they found is they had almost $1 billion in sales and $135 million in tax revenue.
$135 million in tax revenue.
That is public schools, I should add.
And that is nothing to sneeze at, for sure. One last thought I wanted to bring up on the medical marijuana thing. I know that there's some pushback from folks who say, now I can't sell my overages as easy to these local pot shops, when in reality, under the law, you're not supposed to do it anyway. You know, you're allowed to grow your own and then be a caregiver for five extra people. You're not allowed to really sell your overages anyway. This law doesn't let you do it. You're not allowed to do it now. So technically, it's not really a change on anything.
Something to think about with this whole thing is, I think it's pretty well considered that at least physically, marijuana isn't addictive. But I'll tell you, taxes are addictive. Once government has got the taxes and it's going, you know, you almost are guaranteeing it's not going to stop. And I think there's a certain security involved there. If I was a dealer or whatever you call it, the people there, yeah, it's a nuisance. Everybody knows it is. But if they're looking farther ahead, this is a kind of a guarantee going into the future. And here's a thought, too. Once this is established, and I am assuming, and many other people are, and I think they're right, that we are eventually going to legalize marijuana for uses beyond medical, for recreational purposes. Okay, is that going to be more like cigarettes, where we tax it and tax it and tax it forever until it's right on the verge of being extinct? In terms of in this state, you're getting loading up the back of your trunk and bringing them in from other states, or is it going to be like beer, where 10 years from now it becomes impossible to increase the tax? And that's kind of an interesting question. You, which direction is it going to go? And I suspect it might have something to do with which lobbyists pick up on it and how strong they become.
Yeah, I think Jack has a good point here. There's some legislators that would go pretty far for that next hit of sweet, sweet revenue.
Sweet, sweet revenue. Joining us this week for the podcast, we have Kate Madigan. She is with the Michigan Environmental Council, and Liz Kirkwood is with the group known as FLO. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Why are you guys in Lansing today?
Well, today is the meeting of the Michigan Pipeline Advisory Board, and we are calling on the state to take immediate steps to protect the Great Lakes from a rupture from Line 5. So the state is studying the issue of alternatives to Line 5 in the Straits of Mackinac, but there are immediate steps that can be taken instead of waiting multiple years for the studies to be done and any decision to be implemented.
And immediate steps being shutting it down?
Shutting it down. There have been a couple of new developments this summer that have really changed the perspective on Line 5. The first being in July of this year, DOJ and EPA entered into a proposed consent decree with Enbridge for the Line 6B spill in Kalamazoo, which spilled 1 million gallons of heavy tar sands oil into a 35-mile stretch and cost over $1.2 billion to clean up. As part of that consent decree, there were provisions for Enbridge to improve Line 5, specifically installing additional span requirements, anchors, on the bottomlands of the lake bed. So with that, it triggered Enbridge filed a permit application with the DEQ for 22 additional anchors, four of which we learned were out of compliance, that exceeded the 75-foot requirement.
Now, the Attorney General has asked for Enbridge to get this taken care of, and they claim that they're already on top of it. Do you not trust Enbridge to maintain the pipe?
Well, that's not the issue. The issue is that there are laws that Enbridge has to comply with, and Enbridge has to comply with the law called the Great Lakes Submerged Lands Act. So anytime a private company wants to use the private public trust waters and bottomlands of the Great Lakes, they need to get express authorization from the DEQ. In that process, the DEQ, under the rule of law, needs to evaluate alternatives and impacts. And so what we are asking for the DEQ to do is, number one, issue a conditional permit for the four anchors that are out of compliance to ensure that there's no vulnerability on the integrity of the pipeline in those areas. As to the additional 18 anchors, however, we believe that the DEQ should conduct a full-blown investigation on impacts and alternatives that determine what is the actual safety and the fate of this pipeline.
Jacobs is already starting to write down questions. I love it when I see his notepad's got writing on it. Go shoot, Jacob.
With regards to the anchors you were asking about with the DEQ, isn't the Pipeline Advisory Board already studying for assessments and alternatives to the pipeline? The state seems like it's kind of laying the groundwork to make a case for whether the pipeline can stay or not stay as a viable option for moving petroleum. So isn't that what they're already doing as of right now?
Right. So that's a great question. But the difference is very important here. And Enbridge is violating the law. They're in violation with the legal agreement with the state of Michigan. And as part of the engineering design, Enbridge must ensure that there is no span that's greater than 75 feet that's unsupported. There are currently four areas that are in violation. And 2 years ago, when Enbridge secured permits from DEQ to anchor the bottomlands, they made representations to the state of Michigan saying, no problem, once we put these anchors in, it's going to be safely secured. But because we only see this ROV, which is the remote operating vehicle, doing these inspections every 2 years, what we've seen is that currents have exceeded the capacity of what the original engineering design was, and they have created what we call washouts. So literally the pipelines jumped out of the trench where it was resting on the bottomlands, creating a situation that could lead to an actual rupture.
But is it safer, though, to have that underground than if you were to transport it by truck or by boat? Or
yes. And
it is still safer.
Yes.
So really the only...
Let me caveat.
Okay.
Pipelines are absolutely the safest way to transport crude oil. The question is, why are we risking the Great Lakes to transport light crude oil when you have other options and other pipelines that exist around the Great Lakes?
Talk about the others, because
taking
a look at the Enbridge map, it seems like this is the only one to get it from Canada over to Sarnia.
No, Line 6B I wanted to mention this. So Line 6B, actually, when you get to St. Clair River, both Line 6B and Line 5 parallel, and they are tunneled underneath the river itself. But following the Kalamazoo disaster, Enbridge took the opportunity and was given a very quick rubber stamp of approval to double the capacity of Line 6B from 240,000 barrels per day to 500,000 barrels a day. So they have essentially doubled the capacity already in Michigan. And at that point in time, there was not the public awareness that we had a pipeline that was pumping 23 million gallons of oil every single day through the Straits of Mackinac. And that could potentially have been a leverage point for the Michigan Public Service Commission to take Line 5 out of commission.
So what you're saying is we could use Line 6B and we don't need Line 5. There's really no reason for it, is what you're saying.
Yes.
And there are other pipelines in this region that could carry oil to the refineries and could meet the needs of Michigan, the energy needs of Michigan and other Great Lakes states without Line 5.
Because when it goes through the UP, it's not like anybody's taking anything out of that pipeline, right? It's just going from source to refinery.
So our experts at FLO have put together an alternatives analysis where they determined that only 5 to 10% of the oil is being used at the refineries in Detroit and Toledo areas. The natural gas liquids numbers has continued to shift, and it's this moving target for Enbridge. In January of 2016, Enbridge told the public that 85% of the natural gas liquids that were used by residents in the UP that were would be pulled out for a depropanizer with a depropanizer in Rapid River provide 85% of all of the needs. In June of this year, they came back and they said, actually, it's 65%. Our experts are looking at this, and they are starting to pin down numbers. They're much, much lower than these high numbers. Enbridge has come, you know, way below 50%.
And even if we were, if Line 5 were to be decommissioned at the Straits, it wouldn't impact propane delivery in the UP because the propane could still be delivered through the Upper Peninsula along the pipeline.
This all leads to the question. You guys have built the case. You're saying that Enbridge is violating state law. You're saying it's not even needed to serve, you know, the energy needs of what it serves. What? Why do you think the state is not moving as quickly as you'd like? What are you hearing in, you know, whatever conversations you've had with them personally in stakeholder meetings, what have you? What's the reason why?
Well, this is a big case. This, you know, there are two ways to really go at this. There are the strict, pure violations of the easement agreement that all relate to the design integrity, but there are other requirements, for example, liability and insurance. We only have $1 million on this pipeline, insurance with a $100,000 bond. And it is surprising that the state has not demanded, you know, something in excess of $1 billion, given the Kalamazoo disaster. And there's a little bit of confusion about the need for the state to make the case about imminent harm. If you're enforcing a legal agreement, there is nothing in that legal agreement that says that you have to demonstrate imminent harm.
But the reason
there's what we're really talking about is political will to enforce this legal agreement.
And it basically comes down to money. I mean, this is still a profitable pipeline for Enbridge, right? And that's why they want to keep it on. And for the state, they would need to see a risk that is greater than the money and the economic development that this is bringing in.
Right. And the economic benefit of the Great Lakes itself cannot be undervalued or underestimated. The economy just to Michigan alone, it's a $22 billion tourism economy versus the $22 million that the state of Michigan receives in property and sales tax.
Well, what's the chances this pipeline's actually going to burst? I mean, honestly, is it a 1% chance? Would you guys even put it at a 1% chance that this thing's going to burst?
I think a really important question tied to that is what happens if this pipeline does burst? And we saw with the oil spill in the Kalamazoo River, and we've seen oil spills happening in other parts of the country, and it would be absolutely devastating if there were an oil spill in the heart of the Great Lakes.
But the chance has got to be really remote, though, right, Kate?
I don't think so.
The safety margin of the pipeline starts moving rapidly into a high shape of a parabola as the years go out. But the more relevant question is, what is the state of Michigan doing as a sovereign of our public waters? Because that is their paramount duty, to protect the public waters and the bottomlands over that of a private corporate interest that is only there conditionally. So long as that private owner can demonstrate that they're not likely to substantially harm, impair, or pollute this public resource and all the uses, remember, of commerce and navigation and recreation, drinking water. The extraordinary risk that the state of Michigan is taking is not acceptable.
Question related to that. Obviously, a lot of the calls of action have been focused around the state level, but it's my understanding the federal government does have jurisdiction over these kinds of pipelines. So my question is, have the same calls of action been appealed to or asked of the federal government?
The answer, Jake, is no, and that's because they do not have equal jurisdiction with the state. It's not a parallel type. I mean, there is dual jurisdiction of both the state and feds, but if PHMSA, which is the Pipeline Hazardous Safety Materials Administration under the DOT, think of them as a building code enforcer. They are there to help with inspections and maintenance and repair, but they don't have that authority to shut it down unless the regulations right now say that the pipeline can be corroded up to 80% before you could have the feds come in to say it's time to shut it down. And what that means is that the regulations as they're currently written are still very much favoring the evaluation and determination of the pipeline operator themselves. This is a very unique issue, and I can't stress that enough, because remember, these pipelines would never have been built except for the express authority that the state of Michigan granted back in 1953. There was specific legislation called Public Act 10 that was written into law in 2 months by the legislature to authorize the Department of Conservation to allow these pipelines to be built. And that law said that these lands would be protected in perpetuity and held in trust for the benefit of us as citizens. And so it is our gift of the Great Lakes, and they define us, they drive our economy, and you know, ultimately you can drink water, but you sure can't drink oil.
All right, Kate Madigan and Liz Kirkwood, thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to Liz Kirkwood and Kate Madigan for showing up today, and also thanks to the regular crew, Jack and John, Simon, Jacob, and Abigail. And you know, Abby, one of the true medals of being a MERS staffer is participating in festive activities, and today is a very festive day. It is International Talk Like a Pirate Day, and since Roger Kahn is not around, we have to try and make do. You can talk like a pirate, I know you can.
Arr, Kyle, ye a swashbuckling boss yar.
Oh, that ain't bad. I like it. I like it, Blackbeard. All right, you're the only bearded one around here, Jacob Kanzler. What do you got?
Kyle, if we're gonna do international Talk Like a Pirate Day, I thought pirates drink rum, so where's the rum today, is my question.
We don't have rum in this office. We got some Labatt's down in the cellar there if you want some Labatt. Simon, get over here and talk like a pirate.
There's something between like Trucker Randy and a pirate, Kyle.
So are you guys saying that Abby's, do you guys agree, was her pirate better than my pirate?
Kyle, you look like a community theater rejects pirate.
That was harsh.
That was harsh. Joy, Jacob's eyes just went like saucers. Like, did he really say that?
I think you did. I appreciated your effort. I don't know.
Don't diss community theater. I mean, my hometown, shout out to Dearborn Players Guild. Community theater has like a legit program. So, you know, Kyle, it's a pretty high bar.
We're going to have community theater players on next week to rectify this situation.
Well, until then, we're going to close out this podcast. Until next week, I'm Kyle Mullen, talking like a pirate. Take care.